I'm Kevin Middleton.
And I'm Samantha Berg. And this is The Bridge to Everywhere. Welcome to The Bridge to Everywhere. Join us as we explore health, community, and culture from a holistic perspective. Health topics addressed on our show are for information and entertainment and should not be taken as medical advice. If you have a medical condition, please consult an appropriate care provider.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Tonight, we're going to discuss hospice care. Pat Carella, board chairperson and volunteer administrator for Valley Hospice Resources, joins us in the studio tonight to tell us about what hospice is, who needs it, and what resources are available for people or families who need it. And we'd love to have your questions. If you have some comments, just visit our Facebook page, Bridge to Everywhere, and type your questions in on our page there, and we'll ask them on the air.
So before we introduce Pat, I'd like to give you a little bit of her bio. And Pat Carella's family moved to Juneau in December of 1959 from Southern California. She was a freshman in high school at the time she moved up here. Pat holds a BA in sociology from Portland State University and a master's in education from Western Colorado University. Pat spent 25 years doing social services in public and nonprofit settings, everything from adoption and foster care, Head Start, to equal employment opportunity and senior services. Pat and her husband moved to the Valley in 1995. It was about a year after his April 2000 death that she joined the Thursday Night Grief Support Group. For the last 12 years, she has been a recipient of Hospice Services, Grief Group, a volunteer, a part-time employee, bereavement and volunteer coordination, and then a volunteer again. For the past 6 years, Pat has been the board chairperson and volunteer administrator for Valley Hospice Resources. So welcome to the show, Pat. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad that you invited me.
So what we'd like to talk about a little bit first, when we spoke to you on the phone before the interview, we had you had explained to us that Valley Hospice Resources doesn't actually provide the hospice care. So we want to talk a little bit about what you do for Valley Hospice Resources, but then we want to open it up and talk about what is hospice care and get into all the ins and outs. When would somebody require hospice care? What are the kinds of questions you ask? Who qualifies for it? How does it get paid for? All those kinds of things. But let's just start as an introduction into what Valley Hospice Resources does.
Okay. Valley Hospice Resources has a palliative artist who is an exciting thing. For those of you who don't understand palliative art, this lady is a fine artist, and she also has wonderful rapport with patients. She goes into their homes, and she either does art with them or for them. And there's some specific reasons why she does this.
And before we go into that, just the term palliative, because not all of our listeners are going to know what that word is. So I think of it in terms of palliative care, just helping people move through a particular stage in their life, but it's not necessarily, you're not trying to cure anybody, right? You're just trying to make them feel better as they move into that transition.
It's a transition. It usually is before they actually go on hospice. Mm-hmm. And palliative care has several reasons to exist. One is to help patients feel better, work through their feelings about things in their past. I'm going to show this picture. You can't see it on the radio.
But we can describe it.
Okay. You want to describe
it? Sure. So is this one of the pictures that one of the hospice care patients did? Is this?
She did part of it, mm-hmm. and then the artist helped her. This woman was very distraught about the fact that she had a daughter out there somewhere who she hadn't seen since she was a young teenager because of a marital breakup. And she told the artist that what she really wishes was that, she could see her daughter.
Mm-hmm. So the picture I'm looking at is a young woman wearing probably bunny boots and a hat and a scarf, and she's looking out over the vast expanse of mountains in Alaska, and she looks like she's written the words "mom" in the snow. And then below the picture of the woman standing there in front of the mountains in the sky and the word "mom," it says "daughter writes to mom."
So that's exactly what it is. And mom kept the original of this picture on her dresser for the last weeks of her life so that she could, at least to some extent, live something she really wanted to have happen. This one, which is a large drawing in charcoal, is of a middle-aged man and his wife. He's the patient. And this picture was started several weeks before he died. And he had a grandchild on the way. And they weren't sure whether he would live to see his grandchild born.
So this is a picture, this charcoal picture that I'm looking at now is a picture of a man with, I'm assuming, his daughter? And then his wife. Okay.
And the child was born before he died.
Oh, okay.
And so she added in the picture of the grandchild and made copies of this for all the family members. So everybody would have a positive memory of his last weeks of life.
You know what we can do is we can take pictures after at the end of the show real quick with our cell phones, and we can post them up on the Facebook page. So then when people hear the rebroadcast, they can go back to our Facebook page and look at some of these pictures. So
that's
we'll do
great.
That. Yep.
And this third one is a picture that an elderly patient who had never done art before did with the help of the artist. And she used it as her Christmas card. Often hospice patients feel like they can't do anything. Well, here's something that a patient was able to do.
And this is, we're looking at a picture of what looks kind of like a teddy bear with a piece of holly in its mouth.
Yeah.
And it's a very happy-looking bear.
And it was made into a
and it was
card.
Made into a Christmas card. That's beautiful. And so she was able to send that out to everyone as her Christmas card. That's gorgeous.
So those are some of the things that our palliative artist does. And it really can make a difference in the lives of patients. She also works with preteens and teens who are grieving the loss of a parent or grandparent after the person dies. And that's been really successful, too.
And so this is a is this a volunteer program? Is this something that you would have to pay for the services,
no.
or is it so? This
it's
is something
free.
You're eligible for as somebody who's either going through a loss or has had a loss who lives in the Matsu Valley.
It's available for current hospice patients and also people who aren't hospice patients that are nearing the end of life, and it's open to we would consider taking on anyone who's grieving in this program. There's a limited amount of resources, but it's free, and we make it available to the community.
Is the artist a volunteer? Or
we pay position? Her a small stipend and her mileage, but she certainly gives much more.
Oh, yeah.
And she is, she went through an internship to learn palliative art and worked in Florida for many years before she came up here. So she is absolutely marvelous. Her name is Sandra Chandler.
And is she going into people's homes or people coming to you?
She goes into people's homes.
Great. So she works with them in whatever their capacity they're able to work in, whatever medium they want to work in.
Absolutely.
And just helps coach them through that. That's awesome.
She does. Okay, another thing that we do is, and this is the thing that most people may know about, is Light Up a Life, which is our big event at Christmas time. We have remembrance trees at Kozlowski Square, and we also have one at Meadow Rose Square. And we put up Christmas trees. We have volunteers there who can talk about hospice, can listen to people tell their memories of loved ones. And we also use this as a fundraiser. On this tree, we have gold stars for all the people who died on hospice during the past year. And then we offer to other people in the community the opportunity to purchase silver stars or angels to put the names of their loved ones as a remembrance. And then early in January, we have what we call a gathering of remembrance. And it's an opportunity for people who have lost ones to come together, We serve refreshments. We have music. We light candles, and we read all the names. For many people who have lost someone, hearing that person's name is really important.
Well, that's great, because we work in the Kozlowski Center right upstairs from where you are every year with the Christmas tree. And so every year we actually put a name on that Christmas tree, and I never knew that the names were actually read aloud at the end of that. So that's great.
Yeah, we have the gathering at the depot, usually the second Sunday in January.
Great.
We also co-sponsor with Compassionate Friends a weekly grief support group, which meets at the Trinity Barn Church on Thursday evenings from 7 to 8:30. And that group is open to anyone who's grieving the loss of someone. One of the things we found is that if people go through the formal hospice program, they get really good counseling prior to the person's death. And the people who come to the grief support group are usually people who haven't been involved in hospice. And they may have lost somebody in Georgia or Washington or someplace. And they haven't had an opportunity to really grieve that death. And so people come to the grief support group. Anyone who lives in the valley is welcome. And people come sometimes once or twice. Some people come every week for a year. And some people come, drop in now and then when they're having a bad day, like the week of the birthday of the person who was lost.
And is this a group that's mediated by a therapist? Is somebody there to mediate the group, or is it just really self-mediated group?
Well, there's someone from our organization who has lost someone, and there's someone there who has lost a child, which is what the other group, the co-sponsor, is. They're not professional therapists, but they just are group leaders. And it's, you know, a self-help group. But many people start through the grieving process, and they think they're going crazy. And it's nice to be able to go someplace and have people say, no, you're not crazy. This is just part of that process. And it's good for people who have been there for a while, because they're able to look at where they came from in terms of the progress they've made through the grief process. This group is how I started in hospice, is attending that group.
So your introduction to the whole hospice philosophy and hospice in general was through the grief group you had? Yeah.
I was aware of hospice in general, but it was my first real concrete involvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing that we do is we do educational events. We try and do one, community-wide one, every year. This year, we co-sponsored with the Medicare Certified Hospice Barbara Carnes, who is probably the preeminent expert in grief. She was a hospice nurse for 20 years, although she says once she got through nursing school, she should have been a social worker. And she's been talking about it for a long time. And she has a wonderful blog, if anyone's interested. Her blog is Barbara Carnes Books. And it's good information for people who are either currently helping someone through the end-of-life process or people who have lost someone. So I'd encourage people who are interested to check out her blog. The other thing that we do is that we have a small amount of money that we put into mini grants for hospice patients. And this money, it's a limited money, but we do things like, the last one was a gentleman who was in his 50s and had been self-employed, so he didn't qualify for any benefits. And he rapidly went from being you know, self-employed and working hard, to being very, very disabled. And he was being threatened with shut-off notices for his electricity and his gas. So we paid part of the bills so that they wouldn't shut off his utilities. We've also helped people with plane tickets if there was a family member who would be willing to come and be a caregiver, but they couldn't afford to come. So those are the kinds of things that we do mini grants for.
Do people fill out an application to request consideration for those little grants?
Yes,
is that the process?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about hospice in general. So I know this is not a topic that most people tend to think about until they all of a sudden are faced with needing hospice. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Sometimes people just don't realize, like this gentleman you were talking about, it sounds like he declined very rapidly and all of a sudden was in a position where he needed help and, you know, he wasn't expecting to need help. In your 50s, you don't expect that all of a sudden you're going to be going through that process. A lot of people get overwhelmed in caring for a family member at home, or they get overwhelmed with, you know, and they don't know that they really need that extra help. And so I noticed that with some of the literature that you gave us, that it sounds like hospice is frequently underutilized because people might qualify for hospice earlier. They qualify when the person is about 6 months away from
mm-hmm,
death.
Right.
And yet people sometimes don't realize that they could qualify it or that this help is available. So let's just talk about it from your perspective, hospice. Who needs it? When should you think about hospice care? Well, and what's the difference between hospice care and hospital care?
Okay. First, I'd like to talk a little bit about the philosophy. Hospice is a philosophy, and it's a government health care program. The philosophy of hospice is a way of providing physical, emotional, and spiritual care for individuals nearing the end of life and for their families and caregivers. The hoped-for result is the highest possible quality of life for patients and their families, no matter how short that life might be. My personal belief is that somebody is dealing with end of life from the moment someone they love gets a life-shortening diagnosis. It's a journey that nobody wants to take, and most people aren't prepared for. For people who were born prior to World War II, they probably had some idea of what being around people at end of life were like, because they lived in a multi-generational home, and they saw Grandma or Uncle Joe slowly decline in their own home, and the person probably died there. But those of us who are under 70 may never have had that kind of experience.
And this is just the cultural shift in the way
yes,
the family unit is actually
absolutely
changed.
And
Both birth and death are rather hidden in our culture. We had spoken to a midwife a few months back, and we had that discussion about it's two aspects of being human that, I mean, it's everybody is born and everybody dies, and yet there are two aspects of our humanity that we are a little bit removed from. It's very a lot of people are not present at births anymore, and most people are not present at death unless they happen to be in the hospital to see it, you know, or that decline process. It's very much removed from our day-to-day thinking, and so we can sort of push it to the back burner and not think about it.
That's right. And families in this point in the life, when they hear that someone's life is measurably shortened, are not in the best condition, physically, emotionally, or spiritually, to face with all the things, the financial, medical, insurance, you know, all the things that go into it. And this is the kind of thing that people who base their programs on the philosophy of hospice certainly consider. But it's also, many of those things can be dealt with through the Medicare hospice benefit. Right now, the Medicare certified provider in the Valley is Matsu Regional Home Health and Hospice. there are some limitations in that medical benefit. One is the patient has to be within 6 months of death.
Can I ask a question about that? How accurate are the predictions of death, you know, coming from the healthcare system? And how does that complexity, I mean, that can't be an easy thing to really predict accurately.
No.
And when you've got a healthcare benefit that's tied to that, doesn't that get challenging?
A doctor has to certify that the person is probably with it. Under the normal progression of the disease, the person would likely not survive more than 6 months.
And if the person continues 8 months, 10 months, 12 months?
They can stay on hospice. Actually, there are people who end up going off hospice. Yeah. You know, sometimes people go on hospice because the doctor says they're not going to live that long. They may have had several bouts of pneumonia. They may have, their bodies may be really racked from chemotherapy and radiation. And sometimes they bounce back. That doesn't mean that their life isn't going to be shortened, but sometimes they bounce back enough that they're not declining fast enough to stay on hospice. Mm-hmm. And we've had people on hospice, because I used to work for the Medicare certified hospice, who go off hospice and are off hospice for 6 months, 8 months, and come back. Because one of the wonderful things about hospice is their nurses know how to make patients feel better. And their doctor is specialized in dealing with end-of-life issues. So the quality of someone's life can improve greatly if they go on hospice.
And what are the options if somebody – so I'm thinking that having a patient at home who's on hospice and there's – and we'll talk about what that – and, you know, what that might entail for somebody being over – coming to your house and helping to take care of the patient. But – so you've got a hospice person from the Medicare certified facility, which is Matsu Regional. They come over and they help, and they've been helping, and now – the person, let's say, gets a little better, and so they no longer qualify for that benefit. But now who picks up? They're still, the patient probably needs care, though. They may not be in that place where they need require hospice care, but they still probably need care. Is there another nonprofit that's in place to pick up if hospice gets discontinued?
Not the nursing care. Mm-hmm. I mean, the person may be able to go on home health. But if someone's on hospice and they go off hospice, we'll continue to do the palliative artist.
Uh-huh. Yep.
We'll continue to do the supportive things. But if someone goes off hospice, then they lose those benefits that are paid for by the federal government.
So it's and those benefits are the nursing care benefits?
It's nursing care. It's home health aides who come in and do bathing and that kind of stuff. Social worker, which for many families is very important. But hopefully the person has been on hospice long enough that the social worker has been able to help them sort through the legal and financial things they need to. Medicare-certified hospice also has a chaplain. They provide medicine and equipment. And they have volunteers who will go in for 2 or 3 hours a week and give a person a break, the caregiver a break. And then hospice provides grief support for 12 months after the patient dies. Now, there are some the Medicare hospice benefit has limitations. I talked about the 6 months. There are two others. One is that the person can no longer be receiving curative treatment. And for some families, that scares them off. Because the idea of hospice is someone who has admitted that the disease is going to win and their life is going to be shortened. And it's a question of quality of life rather than quantity. the other.
And that's such a delicate threshold,
is.
Isn't it?
It is. And for many families, that's a deal breaker. They choose not to go on Medicare certified hospice because of that.
Yeah, I just read an article online when I was doing some research last night about hospice, and it was the story of a man who he had cancer and he was taking a particular medication that was keeping the cancer from getting into his bones, at least according to his son who was writing the blog. And it was an expensive medication. It was probably $1,500 a month. And the Medicare certified hospice, I believe it was was not going to allow him to be on their hospice care if he continued to take that medication. And the son's argument was, well, this is palliative care because if the cancer gets into his bones, it's going to be extremely painful. And from his standpoint, he felt that the medication was keeping it at bay. Now, I'm not a doctor, so I have no idea what the, whether that was a reasonable argument, but it brought all sorts of things to the forefront, like what is palliative care and what is helping a person stay comfortable and having a good quality of life and where you're actually trying to fight the disease. Or you're trying to do heroics. I'm assuming on hospice that you have a do not resuscitate.
Most people do. Yeah. There does it. They don't have to.
Right. Oh, they don't. Okay.
No. And the government decides what is palliative and what isn't. And so the local hospices who are Medicare certified don't have a lot of choice. Now, some things are considered allowable. Like sometimes there is radiation done not to cure the person, but to stop the, decrease pain. That's an acceptable. I'm not an expert. I'm not the doctor or nurse, so I can't give you those kinds
of. You're saying that the government has guidelines for what medications are acceptable and what procedures are acceptable.
Yes.
And so as long as you are okay with not having those medications or those procedures, then you would qualify for hospice.
Yes.
But if you choose to do some of those procedures where you're trying to actively extend life and you're trying to fight against the disease actively and try and still, that's you wouldn't necessarily, even if a doctor said that you had 6 months to live, you wouldn't qualify for hospice care.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
The other thing, now you would be eligible for the services that Valley Hospice Resources provides.
Got it.
Because we're fortunate in that we don't have to live by the Medicare guidelines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other guideline and the one that is probably the toughest is that there has to be a 24-hour caregiver. Either a family member or a friend or somebody needs to be in an assisted living home. There are people in this valley who don't have those things. And last year, 12 people died in the hospital because the hospital had no place to release them to. And hospice has had to turn down, Medicare-certified hospice has had to turn down patients because they didn't have a 24-hour caregiver.
Interesting. So I think we're about to take a break here, so I think I'd like to pick that back up after the break. So we're talking to Pat Carella of Valley Healthcare, Valley Hospice Resources, and you're listening to Bridge to Everywhere, and we will be right back.
Community radio is what you make it. If you'd like to be involved with Radio Free Palmer, 89.5, Big Cabbage Radio, find us on radiofreepalmer.org. That's radiofreepalmer, one word, .org.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Bridge to Everywhere. I'm Kevin Middleton. I'm here with Samantha Berg, and tonight we're talking with Pat Carella from the Valley Hospice Resources. And Pat, you were just talking about how 12 people died in the hospital environment because they didn't qualify for the benefit for hospice care because there wasn't a 24-hour caregiver at their home. So we wanted to open that up a little bit and talk about that. What can be done?
Well, Valley Hospice Resources has applied to a grant for from the Matsu Health Foundation to study what the needs are in the community at end of life. And one of the things we want to look at is how can we provide 24-hour care for people who don't have it. One of the things we would love to do is have a hospice house. But we need to do this study in order to be able to determine whether this is possible. Anchorage actually spent 5 years studying it and decided not to do a hospice house.
Why?
But then, well, they have nursing homes. They have a palliative wing at Providence Hospital. They have more resources, and I think that's why they decided not to. But there are no nursing homes in the valley.
Are there any hospice houses in the state?
No.
There isn't one in Juneau or Fairbanks or anywhere?
No, there isn't one anywhere. Okay. And so
describe for our listeners, what is a hospice house?
A hospice house is a place where people can go that uses the philosophy of hospice, and it's a place where people can spend the last few weeks or months of their lives. We're anticipating a small one, probably would be more than 6 beds. And we would always want to have at least one bed that was available for people who couldn't be on hospice or couldn't leave the hospital because of a lack of a 24-hour caregiver. We'd also like to be able to use some of those beds for respite care, because families do so much who are caring for people at the end of life. It's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week thing. And sometimes people just wear out. We might be able to extend the time that those caregivers would be able to continue if we could give them a break, maybe just a weekend to themselves, but also to go to a family wedding or funeral, or one of them might need to have surgery and just can't provide for the loved one, the 24-hour caregiving.
In your experience, the 24-hour caregiving, is that usually something that is done by family members, or is it usually something that they have insurance and their insurance benefit covers some in home health care, or is it a combination of things? Like, what usually makes, because obviously one person can't do 24/7 health care, although I'm sure people try. But how does that usually look for somebody? Like, what have you seen for people to pull together to make that work?
There are some resources available. It, to some extent, depends on income. If someone has dementia, Alzheimer's provides people who will come in a few hours a week to give them a break.
When you say Alzheimer's, you mean there's an Alzheimer's
resource agency? Yeah.
Okay, and they provide, if you qualify because you have dementia, they'll provide a couple hours.
They will provide hours. Mm-hmm. They have a sliding fee scale. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Some people can qualify for Medicaid, and if they qualify for Medicaid, sometimes they can get in-home help a few hours a week again. But there are some people who can't qualify for any of these existing programs. So for them, family members, friends from the church, you know, people make it happen. But it is a really tough thing. I mean, families who care for their loved ones are doing an act of love. Yeah. To allow someone to die at home who wants to die at home, that is the greatest gift a family can give somebody.
I'm reminded of our dear Uncle Spencer.
Who was in a hospice house in Ithaca, New York.
He was. Mm-hmm. And our Aunt Pam was just extraordinary, and the care she gave him at home. And it was unbelievable what that took. I don't think she would even be able to say how she did what she did now. She just did what she had to do. But there was a certain point where somebody suggested a hospice house in Ithaca, New York, and she decided this would be the right thing to do at a certain point. Making that decision, things were not turning around, and now it was really about what quality of relationship could they have together. And with her being a caregiver, there was no, you know, it was just constant care, but really being in relationship with her husband as he was dying, there was no space for that. And so moving to the hospice house,
it was a huge change, right, where she could just be, she could go back to being his wife and not his caregiver. And she, like, in the last days of his life, she was able to be close to him and to say goodbye. And they had a quality of life together that if she'd just been, I mean, I almost feel like she would have missed his last few days or few weeks had she continued doing what she was trying to do in her home. So it was such a gift to be able, and you could see that, you know, we saw her at their home trying to take care of him. And then we saw her later on at the hospice house, and she was a different person.
I mean, it was so much better for Spencer, too.
Yeah,
really was.
The quality of care that he could get in a place like that, you know, with the staff who knew what to do, and, you know, and they didn't have that charge of
trying to get
it right.
And that he wasn't a burden on Pam, so that they could just really be together. And the grounds were beautiful, and it created a space where, I mean, if you think about what's happening in that process, is families coming to terms with death and the dying coming to terms with death, and there being an atmosphere that is really beautiful and holding that space with staff that are skilled. They even had Buddhist monks, you know, it was a Buddhist community in Ithaca, and they would come in and they would do service, and just, you know, and there's chaplains, Christian chaplains that would come in too. But it just created an atmosphere that allowed the dying process to be dignified and beautiful.
That's the whole point of hospice, is to help that. And we would love to have a hospice house. It would be the ideal. People, and you're right, caregivers just wear out. I was a caregiver for my mother for 5 years. She has dementia, and I finally got to the point where I just couldn't do it anymore, and my mother is in, you know, assisted living home here in the valley. But I'm fortunate that I can afford to pay for that. There are people who can't do that, and we really need resources to provide that kind of service in the valley.
It seems like end-of-life care, again, it's just not something, it's not particularly flashy. It's not something that people want to think about to spend money on, but we really need it. We're a population that's aging. Everybody dies. And so thinking a little bit about what kind of quality of life we want to have and also what kind of death we want to have, I think, is really important because we're all going in that direction. And so it would be such a beautiful thing if that was really part of a discussion, you know, that we have with people about, okay, what kind of passing do you want to have? Do you want to die at home? Do you want to be in the hospital? And then actually have resources where we can help people bring their wishes to fruition, where it's not just like, well, this is the only choice that you have because financially you're stuck with this option or you're stuck with that option. I mean, it would be really wonderful if people could have the kind of passing that they want. I mean, obviously everybody doesn't get a say, but when you're talking about a long illness and what kind of care you would like, it would be great if people had some more options and choices.
That's very true, and that's why I really wanted to come here tonight. Hospice is a subject nobody wants to talk about. End of life is something we don't want to deal with, and understandably so. But it doesn't have, it's not like being on death row. In some ways, it's like being given an opportunity to live the best that is possible for whatever length of time that is, and for family members to be able to say goodbye. Sometimes it's for family members and patients to have the opportunity to mend fences. And hospice can do some pretty amazing things with quality of life. I remember one gentleman who had brain cancer. And he was getting about to the point where he couldn't do much at all. He was wheelchair-bound. But it's interesting. There are ways of giving treatment to decrease the swelling of the brain, to give somebody another month or two of quality life. This man loved to fish. And by getting the kind of palliative treatment, he was given another month of fishing season. It didn't really lengthen his life, but it increased the quality of his life. And that's what hospice is all about. Improving the quality of an individual's life and helping families to value and get as much out of that whatever period of time that's available to them.
So as a community, what sorts of questions do you think we need to be asking, and who do you think we need to have those conversations with besides each other?
I wonder if we need to unpack, you know, look directly into this issue of death, because isn't that sort of the... How many different ways do we actually try to avoid the reality of a finite life? You know, that culturally it's swept under the rug. We do just about anything not to really face deeply into it. And so when, you know, and even, you know, if there's a family or somebody who's sick, nobody really wants to accept that this might, you know, fight. And you hear that word fight associated with cancer or with any, you know, illness, fight. Even in our own situation with Uncle Spencer, there was one family member in there that was yelling in the hospice. his dad was yelling, "You got to fight, Spencer," and it was all but over. You know, it was only causing more suffering. And I wonder if, you know, you could speak about what have you seen in the people who are actually facing death, who've accepted death. What happens? Is it a scary thing that you're seeing that people go through? Is it something that on the other side of acceptance that there's a freedom or a beauty or, you know, what have you seen?
Okay. I think I'm going to talk about the way Barbara Carnes describes it because she is much more eloquent than I am. She says that at the end of life, there's kind of a veil between the body and the spirit, and there's a tug of war going on because most people are afraid to die. But she says there are three things that slow down the process of people who are very, very ill to letting go. One is unfinished business. And that family members can help with. You know, one is the fear of, for some people, it's a fear that they haven't lived their life as well as they may have wanted to, and they're afraid that whatever they believe they face in the next world, they're not going to be found worthy. And the third thing that she says prevents people from having a good death is pain. So if you can help people be free from pain, which hospice is very, very good at, if you can help people deal with their unfinished business, and then if you can just help them realize that they're good people and they have nothing to fear in letting go. And another thing that she says is that people not only can hear when they're very sick, but she feels that people can still hear you within hours of their death. And so it's really good for family members to continue to converse, you know, and until the mortuary comes to get the body. And when people are on hospice, one of the good things is that somebody from hospice, usually the nurse, comes out and is with the family between the time that they pass away and the funeral, the hearse comes to pick them up. And during that time, for many families, the state troopers come. The nurse is there to help them deal with that, to help them deal with the mortuary. Sometimes families actually, they want to cleanse the body. They want to put the body in clothes before the funeral comes. And that's something that hospice nurses help families do, to give them a little closure. Closure takes a long time, and I'm not sure that...
Does it really exist?
One of the things that we say in hospice is that for survivors, there's a new normal. And it sometimes helps families start to deal with that new normal, which is, I'm no longer a daughter, I'm no longer a spouse. How do I move on without this other person who was so special in my life?
So I want to go into, there's so much more you just said, but there's a logistical point that I want to bring up because I think it'd be useful for people to know. So if somebody dies at home, it's required that you call the troopers or the police?
Yes, it is.
So even though it's been known that the person was dying and you've had hospice care, it doesn't matter. It's still somebody has to call the police or the troopers and let them know that the person has died.
Sometimes if the person is on hospice, hospice will have told them in advance. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the troopers don't come. They have to be notified. But if someone dies at home and hospice is not involved, if Medicare certified hospice is not involved, the troopers do have to be called, or the city police, whatever jurisdiction it is. It's not that there's a question about how the person died. It's just any unattended death requires that the police be notified.
But it doesn't happen in the hospital. It's only when somebody is being cared for at home.
Because in the hospital, it's an attended death.
Mm-hmm. Right, but it's considered a non-attended death.
And if there isn't a medical person there at the time.
Okay, I just want to, I've heard stories about that happening and how it was rather traumatic. We just lost our brother-in-law a couple of months ago and was surprised he died from complications from diabetes. And, we were on the phone with our sister-in-law while the troopers were at the house and, just listening to that, after having just lost her husband and having to have the troopers coming over and, answer questions or whatever it was, I could just see how that would be rather traumatic for somebody to even be able to deal with that. So having hospice there to sort of run interference would be really helpful.
And I'll add to that that's where family and friends were available for her. And what an amazing opportunity for what really matters in life. That presents an opportunity for everybody to see so clearly how important our relationships are. And it was so clear for her, in this time where she was absolutely stunned, shocked, and incapable of really responding to all the technicalities that were happening, unfolding, and there was family and friends there to help her through that process.
Yeah. It's always important to have a support system.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to what you were talking about the dying person being able to hear, even if they seem to be non-responsive. I've heard a lot of stories about people not being able to die until a loved one, it was a wife or a child or a grandchild, actually said to the person, it's okay to go. Like some people seem to be waiting for permission to go. And then also I've heard other stories about people waiting to go when there was a specific person in the room, or people waiting to die, the grandkids are 5,000 miles away and they waited, for the kids to show up so they could say goodbye, even though it seemed the person managed to hold on to life until this one last person who they needed to say goodbye to came in.
That's very true. Another thing that Barbara Carnes says is that people's personalities don't change as they get toward death. And so someone who's very protective may wait until someone leaves the room because they don't want that loved one to have to see the death. And other people who want real control over their life and their families are real important, they will wait for someone to come. Or sometimes they will wait for a date. You know, they want to make it past somebody's birthday or
Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of the last thing people at the very end of life seem to have control over. They seem to be able, within limits, you know, a few days, of either passing into whatever when someone's gone, or waiting until someone arrives.
Well, you can see how challenging it would be to have, you know, to have a family member die on a particular person's birthday in the family, and then every time that person's birthday comes up, then at the same time they're remembering that person's death, versus even one day between and having a separation would be a huge gift.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I know my father was 83 when he died, and he died in the hospital. And I'm sure that he chose his death, because 3 hours later, we were going to be meeting with the doctor, and I know she was going to strongly suggest that we turn off the ventilator. And my mom wouldn't have been able to deal with that. So I really feel that he chose to not make her face that decision.
Yeah, I think from a lot of the stories that I've heard, and even in my own situation, when my dad died, I knew that he was dying. My stepmom had called me, and I flew from Alaska and got there about 24 hours before he died. And the whole family was there, and there was quite a crowd the day before he died. But he actually ended up dying when only my middle sister was in the room with him. Everybody else was gone. She called me up, and I wasn't able to get there in time. But it seemed like it was a really conscious choice to go when this one person was there with him. So I've heard a lot of stories about that. So I do believe that it makes sense that there's control over that.
Yeah. And people shouldn't feel guilty because they weren't in the room. It most likely was the dying person's choice. You hear so often, I went outside for a cigarette, or I went downstairs for a cup of coffee. Well, that's the last thing someone has control over,
right,
is the moment of their death.
I'm sure you get to talk about that at the grief group, that survivor's guilt of feeling like, oh, I should have been there, you know, I missed something, you know, and yet it wasn't up to you, it was up to the dying person. So,
absolutely.
What do you see in the group over time happening with folks? I mean, just can you give a little bit of a sense of the transitions of loss and how people move through that?
Through the grief process?
Yeah, and what you've seen.
One of the most common thing that people say when they come to the grief group for the first time is, I just can't concentrate. I can't remember things. I just can't deal with stuff. I'm just, what's wrong with me? Grief is hard work. Going through the process of grieving the loss of someone is extremely hard work. And if you've been a caregiver, you've probably allowed yourself to get really physically run down. And it takes a while, both physically and emotionally, to get back to what's going to be your new normal. And to me, the mind is a very wonderful thing. It kind of knows what you can handle and what you don't handle. And so people are able to deal with things in little pieces as the mind lets them remember. People usually, of course, they're sad. And the woulda, shoulda, couldas are really bad, especially for people who weren't there when the person died. I mean, we have so many people in this community who family lives somewhere else, and they just, for a lot of reasons, they may not be able to go to the bedside, or maybe even can't afford to go to the funeral. And so you get all these woulda, coulda, shouldas. And that's one of the things the grief group helps people do, is look realistically at those guilty feelings that they may have.
There seems to be a lot of pressure in our culture to sort of move on. Like, I mean, grieving, to me, it seems like, having dealt with a lot of people who've had loss, is that grief looks, you said it's hard work, and it also looks different for everyone. And so a lot of times there's an expectation that there's a certain finite amount of time that's going to be allotted to the grieving process, you know, like as though we could put it on a time clock and say, okay, you can grieve for 2 months or 6 months or a year, but then after that, you're done. So, I mean, do you have people in the grief group being faced with that, where they feel like they're being asked to be somewhere where they're not?
Yeah, that's very common. And one of the things that happens, especially if you have multiple deaths, and they may be 2 or 3 years apart, but if you haven't dealt with the first one, when the second one happens, it's a double whammy. One of the things that we say in the grief group is, you can't run away from grief. You can't go around it. The only way to deal with grief is to go through the process, no matter how painful. And it may, everybody has their own schedule. You know, some people, especially if they've had a long time of pre-grieving, you know, within a few months, they may be doing pretty okay. For other people, it can be a year, it can be 18 months. If it gets much beyond 18 months, then you may need to seek professional help. But if you're not being able to function, you know, just being sad, I know a lot of people talk about they're doing just fine and then a certain song comes on the radio. That's normal grief, and you can do that for 10 years. But if you can't function after 18 months, if you're just not able to get your life on track, then you might need professional help.
Pat, we're down to the last seconds here of the show. How can folks follow up with you or Valley Hospice Resources?
Okay, they can call me. My phone number is 745-4540. Or they can email me at Karella, that's K-A-R-E-L-L-A, at matnet, M-A-T-N-E-T, .com. Or they can contact us through our mailing address, which is Valley Hospice Resources, 1150 South Colony Way, Suite 3, PMB, 349 in Palmer. We also have a website, but our website needs a lot of work.
It's valleyhospiceresources.com, but there is still some good stuff on it, so it's a good place to start. So
thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah. Have a great night.
Thanks for joining us. For allowing me to be here.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on The Bridge to Everywhere, broadcasting on KVRF 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio in Palmer, Alaska. Like us on Facebook at Bridge to Everywhere to access more information, links, and resources from our guests and show topics.